Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, offering the finest assortment of Easter candy from Fannie Mae, Russell Stover, and more. Treat your family to the best. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities online at carthage.edu.
I can hardly bear to pull down the volume on that. It is such a delightful performance of It's a Good Day. And it features my very special guest for part one of today's morning show, Cyrille Aimé. She is a French jazz artist of the highest renown, and she is going to be performing with her quintet tonight at the University of Wisconsin Parkside as part of their celebration of Jazz Week. And she and her quintet, under the sponsorship of the Kenosha Community Foundation. And the concert is tonight at 7:30 p.m. in the Rita Talent Picken Regional Center for Arts and Humanities in the beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall. And I know all kinds of people who are absolutely thrilled at this opportunity to experience singer Cyrille Aimé's artistry in person. And we have the opportunity now to get to know her a bit on this portion of the morning show. Cyrille Aimé, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
I really am an admirer of yours, and I'm so glad that you are coming to town, and I know a lot of other people are excited as well. You are originally from France. Tell us a little bit about exactly where you grew up and the kind of environment in which you developed as a musician, as a youngster.
I grew up in several parts of the world. My parents really love to travel, and my mother's from the Dominican Republic, and my father's French. And I grew up, when I started to realize I wanted to play music, is because I was growing up in a little town close to Paris called Saint-Mois-sur-Seine, and it's the town where Django Reinhardt used to live. And so every year there's a Django festival in his honor, and he was a gypsy, so his family, gypsy family, and gypsies from all across Europe come in their caravans every year, and by hundreds of caravans, and they set camp in the fields in the town. And when I was little, I became friends with the gypsies, and I became really in love with their music and their way of life, and that's how I got to start singing.
Hmm. Tell us more about what gypsy music is like, in particular the music that you were hearing and with which you fell in love.
Well, it's a very driving music that makes you want to tap your feet and dance, and it's music from the heart, not from the head. You don't read charts or know how to write music on paper, but they need music just as much as they need water and air. And it's just it's just fun. And for me, it was the fun factor that made me really enjoy this.
So what was your first sort of serious musical pursuit? I mean, lots of kids love music, but that doesn't necessarily mean they want to make it a part of their own lives in a meaningful way besides just consuming it. At what point did it become clear to you that you yourself needed to be a musician? And how did you go about pursuing that dream then?
There's not really a point in which you discover this. You just start to make music, and then every chance you get, you do it. And you do it more and more, and the more you do it, the more you get chances to do it. And then it becomes where I am today. It's just, like you said, needing to do it. And I just, when I met the Gypsies at first, I wasn't interested in their music. I was just interested in their way of life and their culture, how different it was. I was really fascinated. And I was playing the guitar. My Gypsy friend, he gave me a guitar, and he was teaching me to play the guitar. And in exchange, I was teaching him to read. And one day I learned a song, because it's one of Django's songs had lyrics. It was called Sweet Sue, and I sang it for the whole family, and I saw the smiles on everybody's face, and I just decided that I'd rather sing than play guitar. And then I just kept singing until today.
Have you always been interested in the same kind of singing, or as a vocalist, have you found yourself at different points exploring other kinds of singing as well?
The kind of music or kind of singing?
I guess a little bit of both. I mean, like, for instance, have you explored any classical French art songs or even more contemporary kind of vocal music, or have you pretty much stuck to what you fell in love with at the start?
I don't do Gypsy music now, so right. I definitely have not stuck to that. Gypsy music was what I started with, but then I went to a lot of different things. Today I'm doing a mix of all the things I went through in my life. I mean, I was in a ska band, I was in a trip-hop band. I've been singing bossa nova with a Brazilian guitar player. I did a lot of salsa and bachata and merengue when I used to live in Dominican Republic. I do a lot of French music. I'm a huge Michael Jackson fan. So, no, I definitely did not stick to one style of singing or to one style of music.
Right. Well, I certainly knew that now, that you are a wide-ranging artist. It's one of the things people most admire about you. And it sounds like for quite a long time now you have been that kind of musician that loves to explore the new. I think it would be interesting for our listeners to hear about the experience you had of busking across Europe. This is actually a term that's not quite so well known here in America, although I'm sure some of our listeners know what I'm talking about. But maybe you could say a word about what it means to be a busker and what kind of an experience it was for you to engage in busking for a time.
Well, it was really funny because I at the time when I went to Europe to kind of travel across the countries and to busk around, I invited six of my friends from the college where I was, Purchase College in New York, and they were all American, and they had never gone out to Europe or even come out of the country, and so they all made their passports, and I brought them to Europe, and it did really change their lives. They had never lived anything like that. We were living on the trains, sleeping on park benches, and playing for the people in the street, and it was working out really well, and we had a lot of fun, and we met a lot of great people doing that. We went from France to Spain, then from Spain to Italy, and it was a lot of fun.
My understanding is that now you are based in New York City, Brooklyn, I think I read someplace. kind of where you are headquartered. At what point did you make America your home? And for any particular reason?
Well, I came to America almost 10 years ago to study at SUNY Purchase College. I wanted to be next to the city and be where the clubs were. And then after I graduated, 4 years later, I moved to Brooklyn to stay in the scene and to start a career.
So what is it like to live there? I mean, what does that city mean for you, particularly professionally and musically?
Well, it's an amazing city. There's so many places to play, so many places to go listen to music, so many people to hear, and not just in music, but art in general. And then in music, not just in jazz, but in so many different styles, in hip-hop or in singer-songwriter or in funk, or really, there's so much music. Hmm. It's beautiful to be there. It's inspiring.
Hmm. You are about to come to Kenosha, Wisconsin, and to perform at the University of Wisconsin Parkside as part of their festival known as Jazz Week, and you are coming as part of the Cyril Aimé Quintet. Tell us about this group.
This group is the official band from the It's a Good Day record. It's two guitars and bass and drums. One electric guitarist called Michael Valianou, and one gypsy style guitar, Koran Agan, and bassist Sam Anning, and drums Rajiv Jaiwira.
Hmm. Tell us about making music with these talented musicians.
It's really great. We've been playing together for 3 years, and we are a family, so we love making music together.
Hmm. Sometimes we think of jazz as a genre in which the unpredictable occurs on a very regular basis, that no two performances are exactly the same. Is the kind of jazz you do part of that kind of tradition, or are you more
Definitely.
Jazz musicians where performances are carefully crafted and a bit more predictable? What is your preference?
Oh, I like the unpredictable. That's the reason I decided to get into music, is I love the improvisation. So there's a lot of improvising, but we're a very tight band, so we know how to read each other's minds, and it is carefully crafted, but within that there's a lot of space for improvisation.
Very good. As you look ahead, do you see yourself exploring still more new areas of music, or do you, for the most part at least, hope that you'll get to continue on with what has already brought you such success?
Oh, I want to explore many things, and not just in music. I started taking acting lessons a year ago, so I want to explore this side of the stage, and I want to play with a lot of different people and different kinds of music. So, yeah, I'm always going to be exploring.
Mm. Well, then jazz is the place for you to be. And I know a lot of people are excited about you coming to the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Cyril Aimé and the Cyril Aimé Quintet performing at the so-called RITA, the RITA Talent Pickin Regional Center for Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside in beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall. That concert will be Thursday evening, 7:30 p.m. Tickets will be available at the door. You might want to call ahead if you like. You can visit the website, www.uwp.edu, or call the box office at 595-2564. Again, area code 262-595-2564. Or you can send them an email, boxoffice@uwp.edu. Again, tonight, 7:30 p.m., the Cyril Aimé Quintet in concert at University of Wisconsin Parkside. Cyril Aimé, a real pleasure for me to speak with you today. I have long appreciated your beautiful artistry, and know that a lot of people are looking forward to your concert tonight. Very best wishes to you and your musicians.
Thank you. Goodbye. You know you gotta get moving if you gotta get showing, and you got the right away. 'Cause it's a good day. It's a good day. Yes, it's a good day for starting anew, and it's a good day for thinking of you. It's a good day, and there's so much to do. It's a good day from morning till night, and it's a good day for being yourself. Yes, it's a good day for losing yourself. So it's a good day, leave your worries on the shelf. It's a good day from morning till night. Today, you know you gotta get moving if you gotta get showing, and you got the right away. 'Cause it's a good day for paying your bills, and it's a good day for curing your ills. So take a deep breath and throw away the pills, 'cause it's a good day from morning till night. It's a good day from morning till night. It's a good day from morning till night.
Those are the opening measures of one of the most highly regarded new works for orchestra, Blue Cathedral, by the Pulitzer Prize-winning and Grammy Award-winning composer Jennifer Higdon. This lovely work, this exquisite miniature for orchestra, is going to be performed this weekend at a concert by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. The concert is coming up on the 28th of March. The performance is going to include the overture to Mozart's Così fan tutte and Beethoven's Third Symphony, the Eroica, and this beautiful work by Jennifer Higdon. And we weren't able to arrange conversations with Mr. Mozart or Mr. Beethoven, but we are honored indeed to be able to have on the morning show for this portion of the program Jennifer Higdon, the much lauded composer of Blue Cathedral and a number of other important works. And I'm very happy to have WGTD's own Troy McDonald joining me as well to assist in this interview. Jennifer Higdon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So happy to be making your acquaintance this way. And it's very exciting to know that this beautiful work is about to be performed right here in southeastern Wisconsin. At the risk of having you toot your own horn, give our listeners some sense of just how often and in how many places this work has been played since you composed it.
It's actually been done quite a bit, several hundred times by several hundred orchestras, and there's not a weekend that goes by that it isn't being done somewhere in the world. So it's even moved beyond the bounds of the United States, which is absolutely thrilling for me, and has even crossed over into the world of honors orchestras, high school honors orchestras, college orchestras, and professional orchestras. So it's really kind of a composer's dream come true to have a piece take off like this.
Right. And I suppose it's played so extensively, then maybe it's impossible for you to even keep track of all the performances. I mean, for instance, do you have any particular reason to even be aware of the fact that the Lake Geneva Symphony right down the road from us is performing it this weekend? Or is it just one of countless orchestras playing this all the time?
Well, it gets done a lot, but I've got the fortunate situation set up where actually I run the publishing company, or I used to run the publishing company. It's still in-house, but I have someone who now does that full-time. So because there are special effects in this piece, because we have all these little Chinese bells that occur at the end of the piece, I have to ship those things out to orchestras when they do the work. So I have a pretty good idea of who's doing it when, because I have to carry those things to FedEx, and they're pretty heavy. It's about 20 pounds. So I feel the weight of the performances.
Literally. So this is a work that has, in other words, special requirements. For instance, bells that an orchestra is not likely to have easy access to. Is that what you're saying?
Right, that's it exactly. And, you know, when I wrote the piece, I had never anticipated that it would take off in such a way that so many orchestras would be doing it. I probably wouldn't have put the bells in there had I known that.
How difficult is this work? You mentioned that it is performed by, for instance, honors high school orchestras. It's always a little tricky to just listen to a piece and ascertain just how difficult it is, unless you maybe are a conductor. Even then, maybe it's sometimes tricky to know exactly how tricky a piece is going to be to play.
Right. It's actually not too easy. There are some challenges because there are significant solos in the piece. Primarily the flute and the clarinet have extensive solos. But at some point, most of the principal players in an orchestra will have a solo, and it's a little tricky rhythmically. It's also, a lot of it's written in 5-4, so it's 5 beats per measure, which is very different than the normal. Beethoven would have been using 4-4, 3-4, maybe 2-4. The 5-4 makes it a little unusual because you have to truly be counting. It's having that extra beat in each measure. But I did that in order to give the piece a sense of floating, not so much like a marching band, but literally a music that is kind of floating along. But it definitely has its challenges.
We'll find out more about the piece specifically in just a little bit. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with composer Jennifer Higdon, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, a Grammy Award winner as well. And her work, Blue Cathedral, is one of the most often performed of modern works for orchestra. And it is being performed this weekend by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. Troy?
Jennifer, first of all, I was fascinated by your background and the fact that in an interview I saw that you were not even a fan of classical music and that you kind of fell into this genre. So explain kind of how that process happened for you.
Yeah, I grew up in a household that had a lot of rock and roll and 60s folk music. My dad was a commercial artist who worked at home. He had a studio in the back of the house, and he always had music playing. But it wasn't classical music, in fact, and we just didn't have it playing in our household. But I found a flute that my mom had bought at a pawn shop in a beginning band method book. And I don't think she bought it, but I don't think she ever picked it up and tried to teach herself to play. And for some reason, when I was in my teenage years, I decided that I wanted to learn to play this instrument. We didn't even have a piano in the house, but something about it called to me. And I taught myself to play. I worked my way through all the band method books. And then I joined the high school band. I was playing percussion for a little while, and then I switched over to flute. But I learned to read by actually using that book. But this also meant that because I was playing in a marching band, we were basically doing music that you encounter in movies. I remember one year we did the soundtrack for Rocky, the movie. So kind of appropriate since I live in Philadelphia now.
Oh,
I
wow.
have a deep appreciation for that. But I didn't really know classical music. I'd heard a few recordings, random recordings that I checked out at the library. Someone bought me an album, Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. And ironically, I had an 8-track tape.
Oh,
this
wow.
is how far back it is. Yeah, an 8-track tape of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. I don't know where I got that thing, but I think that probably influenced me. But I went off to college to major in music pretty much knowing no classical music. It was very little, like a Bach sonata here and there. When I think back to how much I didn't know, it's a little astounding. And maybe it's good I didn't know how much I didn't know.
Do you think that that allowed you to be creative because you didn't have any preconceived ideas of what it should be?
Yeah, I think that actually has made a difference in my composing. I mean, once I entered school, I realized how much I had to catch up, and I really spent a lot of years going through a lot of degrees, basically catching up, even taking the remedial classes, and music students go into a school, and they will test to see where you are. I was always in, let's begin from the beginning. I do think in a certain way, sometimes a composer's brain is wired according to the music and the sound world that they've grown up in. That's kind of their familiar territory. So for me, it wasn't classical music. It actually was, I guess, rock and roll, basically. I heard lots of other kinds of music living in East Tennessee at the base of the Smokies. I heard bluegrass and country. But rock and roll and folk music, those are the things that were playing in my household. The Beatles, primarily, that was a big influence. I think my sense of timing when I need to turn phrases over in the music maybe curves a little faster because that happens faster in more popular sorts of music. But it has kind of given me permission to step beyond the normal boundaries and kind of break the rules. It was very hard for me in school because I was always in trouble for breaking the rules, but it works really well as a composer.
Yeah, it's funny how that those things kind of happen that way. With special.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you are in college, like you said. Where do you get the chutzpah at such a young age to say, you know what, not only am I going to step into this genre, I'm going to step into this world, I'm going to compose. Take that.
Yeah, that's a good question. It started with my flute teacher because I was a performance major in my undergraduate days. I was playing flute, practicing a lot, and she had me write a little piece, like a 2-minute piece for flute and piano, and I loved the feeling of, I guess, arranging sounds. And I love the fact that you could write it down and then you could actually play it and it would come out and it would be a piece. I realized that you could create worlds. And I think that there was much more creativity allowed in the act of composing than there would have been, say, if I was playing a Bach flute sonata. I think it was more of a matter of not knowing decisively right off the bat, but just being fascinated with arranging sounds. And slowly through the years, that kind of just took over more and more of my life. I could tell that my interest was growing. It just felt like it offered more for me. And so I finished my bachelor's degree in performance, but I did make a switch after that into composition. And I have to admit, for many years, I wasn't sure that I would be able to pull this off. But at some point, it was probably when I won the Pulitzer, I thought, oh, wait, I guess I probably have caught up now. I probably can do this.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with composer Jennifer Higdon, and her very, very highly regarded piece, Blue Cathedral, is about to be performed this weekend by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra in a program that's also going to include music of Mozart and Beethoven. So, Jennifer Higdon, describe what your first efforts as a composer might sound like if they're not banished to the wastebasket and unheard of or forgotten by you or to whatever extent you remember. I mean, as you first began actually composing, was there any sense of where things were headed for you as a composer? Did those early works in any way resemble the kind of works that you are creating now?
You know, they probably did. I imagine there were little kernels, and I actually don't know where that first piece is now. My opus minus one, you might want to call it. That was such a simple little piano and flute piece, but it did evoke kind of a world of mystery. I remember the piece was called Night Creatures, and it had kind of a mysterious sort of sound, very simple part in the piano, and it had some extended techniques on the flute. And I'm sure that's because I was in a studio where the teacher made sure we were learning new works as well as traditional repertoire. But now I think back on it, that probably that trying to find a different sound world and realizing that a piece has to be its own world. Each piece is different, and you have to kind of create the world around that piece. There probably are little pictures of me, or at least a little snapshot of what I would become as a composer. it's kind of interesting when you're a composer and you write a lot. I mean, I write a lot. I write every single day. You don't ever stop to analyze this stuff. You just go on to the next piece. You're thinking about the one you're working on with an eye to the future as to what the next project is. You never really stop to look back and say, wait a minute, can I actually draw a trajectory from Night Creatures all the way to Blue Cathedral? But I bet if some doctoral student did that in a musicology degree, they probably would find all kinds of small connections that I think of on a subconscious level. So it's not actually really present at the front of my mind, but it probably occurs on the page if someone were to really sit down and examine it.
What about the relatively mundane, although by no means not unimportant, matters of just sort of making a living, of functioning professionally as a composer? What kind of guidance were you given in terms of how to make a living? And early on, were you in fact trying to make a living as a composer, or were you cobbling together kind of a complicated professional existence that included composing in the center of it?
It's a really good question because they don't normally teach this in school. They don't teach freelance composing. But because I grew up in a household where my father was a freelance artist, I was kind of accustomed to thinking like a freelancer would. When I first came out of college, I had a few commissions, but not enough to really pay the rent. And I actually had quite a bit in student loans. At that time, I was cobbling together a living. I was doing some writing. I was doing some teaching. I was doing some professional music copying. I was playing the flute. So there were a lot of odd jobs, and I kept on composing, and I would write music for friends, and occasionally someone would offer me a commission for some small amount of money. And what has happened over the years, by just kind of sticking with it, and I've had a couple of really fantastic breaks that were kind of monumental. Blue Cathedral actually being one of them. After a while, it became apparent I was going to be able to make a living as a composer. And I'm very lucky. I mean, you mentioned Beethoven is on this program. Beethoven was pretty poor during his life. And, in fact, there was this interesting book called Beethoven and the Construction of Genius. And in that book is a table that actually lists the number of performances that Beethoven had over his 19 years of living in Vienna, which is like the capital of the world of music. And he had about 90-some-odd performances over 19 years, and I have several hundred each year. So it's actually much easier now to make a living as a composer than it was in the day of Mozart and Beethoven. Those guys actually had it much harder. They didn't own their houses, and they were really scraping by. But getting back to how does a composer do this, I often tell students, you have to do the very best you can when you're writing a piece. You have to pretend this is the last piece you're ever going to be allowed to write. Ever. Put everything you have into it because you don't ever know what kind of opportunity is going to come up. When I wrote Blue Cathedral, it was for the anniversary of Curtis. It was the 75th anniversary, and Curtis is the conservatory where I teach. And so I wrote the piece, but I didn't know at that time that Robert Spano was going to be conducting the work. And he had just gotten the Atlanta Symphony, a music directorship there where he currently is. And I also didn't know that the Atlanta Symphony records for Telarc recordings. So one of the first things after we premiered this, he said, I'd like to record this work. And that recording has made it possible for a lot of people to hear the piece and also program it. So it's kind of hard to say. You can't really predict what the trajectory of your career is going to be. But I tell students all the time, you have to absolutely do the best you can at all times because you never know when that door is going to open, the door that's going to be an important venue for you kind of moving your career forward. But I'm very lucky. I work with great musicians. I work with very enthusiastic, high-skilled musicians. And so as a consequence, I get great recordings of my works, and I get lots of performances. And I actually feel like I must be the luckiest composer on the planet.
Well, I don't think it's all luck, but luck has something to do with it. And I'm glad you mentioned specifically that beautiful recording. That's, of course, what we were sampling. I just purchased it off of iTunes, as a matter of fact, this Telarc collection of actually four different 20th century works, and among them this piece, Blue Cathedral. For those of you just joining us, Troy McDonald and I are speaking with composer Jennifer Higdon, and her work, Blue Cathedral, is being performed this weekend by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. Troy?
Important is it for, you mentioned the conductors and the kind of situation that allowed Blue Cathedral to become the success that it was. How important is that kind of championing the kind of push that you got there to make that song a success?
I actually think it was pretty important. I mean, we could have had just the premiere and it would have been a one-time sort of performance, and it might have gotten picked up by some smaller orchestras. But the fact that the piece was recorded so beautifully by a recording company that actually takes great care and by a skilled orchestra with a conductor who is very good with new music made such a difference, because it, astoundingly, that recording came out something like 13 or 14 years ago, and to this day, it's still selling great guns. And in classical music, that's unheard of. It's completely unheard of. So it's staggering. Most people don't realize this, but classical recordings often only sell anywhere between 50 and a couple of hundred copies. That's all that usually gets sold. But I can tell you this year alone, and we're quite a ways out from the release of that disc, I think there were close to 9,000 units were moved. That's downloading and CDs sold. So it's a staggering sum. And I realize that because it goes out and it's played on the radio and it gets performed a lot of places and people will hear it on a concert, then they buy the recording. It's done everything. I think it's the thing. It's like pouring the most perfect sort of mixture of growing material on a plant and just watching the thing explode. It's a little bit like Jack's magic beans in a certain way. I'm really blown away. I didn't know it was possible that a piece could go out into the world in that way and continue to thrive and literally kind of like grow every year. It's kind of staggering even for me, and I've been watching it for a long time.
I'm kind of curious on your thoughts on, as you said, the units sold usually 50 to 100, but obviously 9,000, huge in classical music. I'm curious, as a member of the Spotify and YouTube generation myself, how you view that kind of digital technology in music and how that's affected classical music.
Well, it's actually affected most music in general. It's funny you mention this. I've been on some panels that have talked about this. They're discovering that the copyright laws that were written by Congress ages ago and another century altogether don't protect artists with the streaming services. So if you have something like 10 to 20,000 streaming, someone's listening to your works, you normally only get a couple of pennies.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually, for artists, it's pretty damaging. And right now they're trying to figure out how to cope with this, because the fact of the matter is, if it keeps going in this direction, if we go into a situation where everybody takes their music in by streaming, there won't be any composers, there won't be any pop musicians, there will be no one writing new stuff, because it won't be possible to actually make a living. So I know for a fact right now that Congress is working on restructuring the copyright law, because now they have to take into account a different way of consuming on the digital end. And I know the landscape is shifting. Probably in the next year, that will go down. And actually, they'll change the way that that's actually done. It's a fairly rough thing. I'm not kidding. I've had a lot of streaming last year. It must have been 30 or 40,000 streams, and I got 4 cents, four pennies.
Wow.
Wow. That is shocking.
It is. And I've heard some of the pop people who've had as many as 20 and 30 million streams have only had a royalty of, I think it was like $2,000.
Yeah.
So if you're having, you know, millions upon millions of streaming and you're walking away with that little, there's no way to actually support a band for them to make another album or anything like that. So the landscape is changing, but we're all trying to pay attention to it and figure out the best way to do this so that the artists can still make the art and so the people who listen to it can also listen to it.
Let's hear a little bit more about this specific work that is on the program this weekend, Blue Cathedral. You mentioned that it was composed for an anniversary of one of your alma maters, I believe. Tell us more about that and more specifically the sort of musical ideas that really prompted it.
Yes, the Curtis Institute of Music back in 1999-2000 was celebrating its 75th anniversary. And it's a school where there are like extraordinary musicians who come out of it. Leonard Bernstein went there as a student. Samuel Barber, Giancarlo Minotti. So there have been a lot of people, even Nina Rota, who wrote the music for The Godfather. But they like to commemorate their anniversaries with music. And so they commissioned me to write a piece, and they didn't really tell me much about what they wanted. They just said, we'd like a piece that is 10 to 15 minutes. So I started this work about a year after losing a younger brother to cancer. My brother, Andrew Blue, his middle name was Blue, had died very quickly. He'd had skin cancer. And so because I think it was still like in this period of profound thinking and grief and processing, I decided to write a tone poem about music that commemorates people and the paths the people who cross our paths in a lifetime, the way they affect our paths. And so I was thinking about my brother's middle name, Blue, which made me think a lot about the sky. And I was thinking about the fact that often we have, like, touchstones in our lives, and often cathedrals represent those touchstones. There are a lot of things that go through cathedrals, events involving births, deaths, marriage, fellowshipping, learning, wisdom. And so I thought, well, you know, the image of a cathedral in the sky, and that got me thinking about an image basically of a glass cathedral in the sky. I figured if you were in a glass cathedral and you look out, you'd see the blue of the sky. So while I was writing this, I have some flute solos because I'm a flute player, and there are clarinet solos because my brother played clarinet. And so I actually envisioned the listener floating into the back of the cathedral and passing all of these crystal pillars and the light glinting off the pillars. And I imagined stained glass windows that were making music, that you could actually hear music coming out of them. And I imagined floating up towards through the front of the church, and I imagined going up towards the ceiling and actually the ceiling disappearing and going up into the stars, which is why I used the little bells at the end, because I thought, how would you replicate the sound of stars? But during the process, because Curtis is made up of a bunch of really talented musical students, I thought it was kind of fascinating to commemorate the fact that a lifetime is made up of all the individuals that you meet. So there are a lot of solos. There's English horn solo, clarinet solo, flute solo, horn solo, trumpet solo. There are tons of solos throughout the piece because an orchestra is made up of a bunch of individuals, but they also play collectively together. And so this is a tone poem. It's about life, and it's about how people touch us. And I had the flute come in early first because I was the older sibling. And if you notice at the end, the flute cuts out and the clarinet kind of finishes off the piece, because I thought, well, my brother's journey is going on ahead of me. Even though I was the older sibling, he's going on ahead of me in his journey. So it's a very emotional piece, and it's very personal. And it's kind of funny. I consider it the greatest compliment when someone comes up after performance and they just take your hand and they can't speak because they're very teary. It's an amazing thing. It's a privilege to write music that can touch people. So I feel lucky that I've been given the opportunity to do that, but I also found it was very cathartic writing this piece, and it's been a really wonderful surprise that so many people have embraced it.
How long ago was it that you composed this?
This, I started it in 1999, so it would now be 16 years ago.
Do you remember feeling any sort of special pressure because you were writing it for Curtis?
You know, that's a good question. I probably normally would have in most circumstances, except I was experiencing so much grief, that was just rolling over everything.
Uh-huh.
There were, like, no other emotions that could kind of get through at that time. Because I had originally intended, because it was an anniversary, to write kind of a fanfare type of piece, but my head was having none of it. My head's like, no, something else needs to be there.
Right. Well, it sounds like following your heart in this instance was exactly the right thing to do. Troy?
You seem like you would be like the best composition teacher because of your background and kind of how you came into this genre. So what is it like for you teaching composition to the next generation?
It's actually fun, and it's also, I think it's a real privilege. I feel like if you're lucky enough to be able to make art, you should be sharing it with people and also helping to kind of train the next generation. One of the things I love about teaching is the fact that oftentimes if I'm having to explain something to a student, it kind of helps me to articulate the way I think or feel about things, which sometimes when you're making art, you don't really think on the front end of, like, the consciousness saying, oh, yes, I must do this because this would work better this way. But when I'm trying to explain things to students, I find that two things happen. I get better about figuring out what I'm doing, but I also learn from the student. I learn how the student is receiving the information, whether I'm communicating clearly. And because composition is about communicating, I consider that a very important lesson. And it's fun also to watch them go through the process of figuring out how they're going to have their own voice. That's the most important thing for a composer, that they stay kind of true to their own voice and not try to follow along with what someone else is saying they must do. I'm very adamant that the students have to find their own compositional voice, and a lot of times the big issue is trying to get them past any kind of psychological or emotional barriers or fears that they may have, which is common when someone's creating something from nothing. It's amazing how your brain can get in the way. And trying to figure out how to get your brain to get out of the way, it's an interesting challenge. And it's actually, it's different for every single individual composer who walks into a classroom.
And I suppose that's what makes it such a joy to be a composition teacher, in addition to being a composer.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Composer Jennifer Higdon's work called Blue Cathedral is being performed this weekend by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. Jennifer Higdon, it's been a great privilege for Troy McDonald and I to interview you today, and we wish you well in all that you create from here on out, and we appreciate you joining us today on The Morning Show.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Once again, the Lake Geneva Symphony's concert is on March 28th at Badger High School. The program includes Beethoven's Eroica Symphony and the overture to Mozart's comic opera Così fan tutte. By the way, although we didn't get around to asking her, Jennifer Higdon is hard at work on her very first opera based on the novel Cold Mountain. It is receiving its world premiere later on this year. The concert on March 28th is at 7:30 p.m., and you can go online to lakegenevaorchestra.org or by calling 262-359-9072, 262-359-9072. Here is a little bit more of this beautiful new masterwork by Jennifer Higdon, Blue Cathedral, featured on this weekend's concert of the Lake Geneva Symphony.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Andrea's, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, offering the finest assortment of Easter candy from Fannie Mae, Russell Stover, Madeline Chocolate, and the famous Pectin Gel Jelly Beans. Visit Andrea's on the corner of 60th Street and 24th Avenue in Kenosha and treat your family to the best. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Precisely 8:59. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. We'll be joining Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming here at 9 o'clock. But between now and then, we can check the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, March the 26th. Partly sunny, breezy, and seasonal today, heading for an afternoon high of 40. To put a little perspective on that, normal high this time of year would be 46. The record high for this date, we hit 80 degrees, March 26, 2007. And right now, 36 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha, 34 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, 37 in Milwaukee. 9 o'clock, classical music next from Wisconsin Public.